Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Ebony Tucker. I'm the Advocacy Director for the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence. We have a few speakers on this call with us today, and so we will go ahead and go through our prepared remarks briefly and then leave as much time as possible for questions if anyone has them. So I want to first start by saying that as I said before, I'm the Advocacy Director for the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence, and we agree with many things, if not overall, with the report issued by Rachel Mitchell. Our feeling is that Dr. Blasey Ford bravely testified in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee with no prior investigation, though she very reasonably requested one, only to have Rachel Mitchell interrogate her as a suspect and then issue this report. This report picks apart a survivor's testimony, pointing out minor inconsistencies to cast doubt. And quite frankly, I think we weren't just disappointed. We were angered by the positions taken and would like to discuss that some today. As an example for some of the things that were pointed out as minor inconsistencies and common of victimization were the way that sexual assault survivors term abuse. So usually early on after disclosing or during the time of early disclosures, sexual assault survivors tend to use language other than what explicitly happened to them. So for instance, saying that someone did something inappropriate or something that made them uncomfortable can often be used in place of words such as rape or sexual assault in early disclosures. For this very common trait of victimization to be used as a way to question credibility, is victim blaming and frankly disingenuous. There are many things that Dr. Blasey Ford remembers specifically and clearly, including her actual sexual assault, and we feel that those issues should have been included in the report. We're also greatly frustrated that Judge Kavanaugh's testimony was not discussed or analyzed. We feel that it is his burden to prove he meets the standards of character and fitness necessary to be a Supreme Court justice, and yet that has been forgotten in this report. Advocates and prosecutors can have complicated relationships. We understand that. We don't always agree. I can say that as an advocate, it's very true when it comes to decisions of whether to prosecute cases. However, I can also say that I've never worked with a prosecutor who made decisions about the legal fitness of a case prior to an investigation, as what's been done here. This report only makes the need for a full, fair investigation more apparent than it was previously. The nation deserves a full and serious investigation into the sexual assault allegations against Judge Kavanaugh, including all relevant witnesses before the Senate moves forward. So I want to take a, I want to now pass it on so that we can have some of our other speakers give you their opinion after reading the report. First, we're going to hear from Michelle Anderson, who's the president of Brooklyn College and expert in sexual assault law.
Hi, everyone. I'm Michelle Anderson, and want to say a few things about the Rachel Mitchell report. Rachel Mitchell concludes that no reasonable prosecutor would bring a case against Kavanaugh based on the evidence before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And I think that this is a strange conclusion because the Senate Judiciary Committee allowed very little evidence in front of it. Mitchell supports her position that no reasonable prosecutor would bring a case here based on a detailed picking apart of Ford's testimony. Her analysis of Ford's testimony is a collection of immaterial points and minor inconsistencies, some of which Mitchell did not even give Ford the opportunity to clarify under oath. Mitchell's analysis, therefore, adds up to very little, especially given the reality of how different kinds of memories are encoded in the brain and then recalled later, which I know another expert is going to testify about here or talk about here. Importantly, Mitchell says that her judgment is based on an independent review of the evidence before the Senate Judiciary Committee, but she only picks apart Ford's testimony. In stark contrast, she offers no analysis whatsoever of Kavanaugh's testimony or his veracity based on his responses under oath. This is not what a reasonable prosecutor would do with the evidence in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Mitchell calls this a weak case of, quote, he said, she said, unquote, And it seems to me that this is an artificial construct created by the Senate Judiciary Committee itself. There was no opportunity for Dr. Ford to call witnesses to support her claim of sexual assault. It appears that the Senate Judiciary Committee majority wanted to reduce the complexity of the case to a he said, she said situation by allowing only the he involved and one she to say anything on the record, and then blocking relevant testimony from other witnesses who might have shed additional light. For example, of course, there was no subpoena of Mark Judge, no opportunity for Deborah Ramirez to be heard about a second claim of sexual misconduct by Kavanaugh. So Mitchell comes to this unfortunate conclusion based on very little evidence, especially given that an investigation by the FBI was authorized by the time she issued her report to the Senate Judiciary Committee. So I would think that prosecutors would reserve judgment pending the development of a factual record from an FBI investigation. But here, Mitchell does not reserve judgment, and based on the evidence in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, focusing exclusively on minor inconsistencies and immaterial points in Ford's testimony, she comes to the conclusion that this is not a case worthy of moving forward.
Thank you, Michelle. I'm going to pass it off to Roger Caniff now, who is a former prosecutor and senior attorney at the National District Attorneys Association and current partner with Justice 3D.
Hello, everyone. My name is Roger Caniff, and thank you very much. My background is in prosecution. As you may know, I am currently a partner and consultant with Justice 3D. That's correct. It's a small training company based out of Virginia. I have been in the business of prosecution of special victims cases, either prosecuting them and or training or consulting on them for about 20 years. I want to say first and foremost that Rachel Mitchell is someone that I know. She is someone that I have done child abuse prosecution training with. And I want to say fully, I have always known her to be a decent and honorable public servant. I think she's a very good attorney, and she has dedicated her life to the elimination of violence against women and children, which is why I'm all the more surprised at the report that she drafted, and it's unfortunate. I echo quite a bit of what Michelle has said with regard to the deficiencies in that report. The bottom line is it appears to me really to be a conclusion in search of evidentiary points to support it rather than a series of evidentiary points then leading to a conclusion. It's almost impossible to escape what appears to be just the apparent nature of the report, that it seems as if Mitchell kind of made up her mind and is saying, all right, well, what things in Dr. Ford's testimony can I bring forward in order to support this? That doesn't sound like her, but I am not sure what else is going on. As Michelle said, the inconsistencies that Ms. Mitchell pointed out really are, in almost all cases, distinctions without a difference. For instance, she says Ford was slow to identify Kavanaugh. Well, she really wasn't. The fact is she identified him to her husband several years ago. Mitchell tries to make a point, something to the effect of, well, at that time, Kavanaugh was being suggested as a Supreme Court justice in the event that Mitt Romney was to win the presidential election in 2012. I just think that's a ridiculous stretch. She also states that at one point, she, Ford, described the incident as a sexual assault and then to someone else described it as physical abuse. Well, that means nothing because the fact is the incident had both a physical abuse component, i.e. jumping on her and putting a hand over her mouth, and also a sexual component, i.e. trying to get her clothes off. So there's really just no inconsistency there at all. And that pattern just sort of follows. The various things that Ms. Mitchell points out from Dr. Ford's testimony, just they don't add up to consistencies that would give any reasonable prosecutor pause. That doesn't mean that a criminal case against Brett Kavanaugh could be brought. I don't really think that would be possible. But obviously, Brett Kavanaugh is not on trial. There's no liberty interest at stake here. The question is whether or not he has the character, whether or not he should be entitled to a lifetime position on the United States Supreme Court. And why Ms. Mitchell took it upon herself to evaluate forge evidence in the context of as if this were a criminal trial. Even though she states she did not, it just doesn't make any sense to me. So that's basically in sum what I would say. Of course, I'll be around to answer questions, and I thank you all very much for including me.
Thank you, Roger. Now I'm going to have our last speaker, Philip Zolas, Associate Professor of Psychology in the Departments of Psychology, Sociology, and Criminal Justice at Ohio Northern University.
Hello, thank you for having me. My name is Philip Zolas, and I've been conducting research on how stress affects learning and memory for the past almost 15 years. What I find most concerning about Prosecutor Rachel Mitchell's analysis and about some of the public's assessments of Dr. Ford's memories is that Dr. Ford's lack of detailed memory for the day of the sexual assault is being used to suggest that the sexual assault never happened or that Dr. Ford is inevitably mistaken about key aspects of the sexual assault. In her analysis, Prosecutor Mitchell questioned Dr. Ford's recollection of, quote, small, distinct details from the party unrelated to the assault, end quote, and emphasized, most importantly, according to her, that, quote, she does not remember how she got from the party back to her house, end quote. When encoding any event, we focus more attention on aspects that our brain appraises as important, the central details, and less on those deemed insignificant, the peripheral details. As a result, the central details are more likely to be stored and remembered. And as I and other experts have noted, stress exaggerates this attentional focus, which enhances the storage of the most central components. However, it's crucial to emphasize that what one individual appraises as being important or central to an event can differ significantly from what another individual appraises as being important or central to an event. Thus, what Dr. Ford remembers about the day of the sexual assault and about the sexual assault itself would reflect what Dr. Ford's brain appraised as most important during those experiences. My own research over the past 10 to 15 years has shown that stress exerts time-dependent effects on learning and memory. Simply put, stress enhances the storage of information that occurs around the time of the stress while impairing the storage of information that is temporarily separated from the stress. In other words, Dr. Ford would be expected to remember more about the sexual assault and things that happened around that time than remembering what occurred after the sexual assault. Based on extensive research from my lab and from that of other investigators, stress appears to trigger what we call an excitatory phase of brain activity during which the storage of incoming information is enhanced. However, after some period of time, the brain transitions from this excitatory phase to an inhibitory phase during which the storage of incoming information is impaired. And in Dr. Ford's case, the onset of a sexual assault would enhance the storage of information that was presented during, shortly before, and shortly after the sexual assault, of course, the most central aspects, while anything presented a longer time after the sexual assault would be impaired. This explains why Dr. Ford would not be able to remember how she got home that evening. Her brain would have gone from an excitatory state initiated at the time of the sexual assault to a more of an inhibitory state, and information processing would be inhibited. Jim, do you have anything to add to this?
No, I think that's wonderful, and that's why I thought it was so important to have you on this. And I couldn't say it any better myself. I mean, I think we could look at particular things and add things in the questions if the journalists have any questions about it, but I think you summed it up perfectly.